guest today is an old friend, Jérôme Sagard from Sciences Po in Paris, and someone who has done all kinds of really fascinating, deep research into, well, frankly, any number of topics. But I would say in this context, the kind of broader political and economic and social context of the way that sovereign debt crises were resolved in the 1980s, before the current era of bond lending. And we were especially excited to talk to Jérôme because of his new book, The Debt Crisis of the 1980s, which has all kinds of fascinating and, at least to me, completely novel historical insights about the evolution of policy at the IMF and about the way various players involved in the sovereign debt market kind of fumbled their way towards a restructuring regime that that culminated in the Brady Plan that transition to the modern bond era. And so we wanted to talk to Jérôme about his book and all the wonderful sources that he found in the context of doing his research. And so, Jérôme, thanks so much for joining us. We're really thrilled to have you.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation.
Can you tell us the backstory of this book, the discoveries that led you to all of the archival research that you did in the IMF archives and elsewhere, and the oral histories, in a sense, that you took of some of the key players? What was it that that motivated the book?
The motivation, I think, was mainly that the debt crisis of the 80s was a big event during those times. You had a lot of publication, you had a ongoing public debate, but once the Brady Plan proved a success, 89, 92, it was broadly forgotten. The whole episode was declared over, and everybody rushed into the new brave world of open capital market and emerging market crisis. And if you look at references, bibliography on the 1980 crisis, you see from 1992 and 1994, you essentially have one reference, which is the nice book by the IMF official historian, James Boston, has done a good work here in the IMF archives. But otherwise, you don't have a lot of things. So I started from the view that, well, we have to move back there, that the whole debate on sovereign debt restructuring over the last, say, 20 years unfolded very much in the absence of a basic understanding of what had happened in the 80s. So that was a starting point.
So, Jérôme, just to follow up a little bit on the motivations question and methodology question, you use a lot of oral histories, if that's the right word, or interviews, and do a lot of archival work. And this is a different research strategy than most of our economist colleagues usually use. And given that you are in that milieu, I was wondering about the choice to use this sort of multi-method research strategy, which I should say I love. Your book is a delight to read and going to be a very important source for my classes, at least. But I'm curious as to how you made that choice, because maybe it was obvious, but I want to know.
Yeah, it started in a completely unexpected way. I was working on a completely different subject, namely arbitration. And just by chance, I met in Paris Jacques Delarosière, who was the head of the IMF during the large part of the 1980s. And so we started talking. And after a while, the project emerged of a kind of book of testimonies by him and his main partners from those years. Bill Rhodes, who coordinated the bank, Charles Darrara, who was a US Treasury, a Mexican negotiator, like Guillermo Ortiz, and so on. And essentially, it started from there with the project of a book of testimony with some kind of a large introduction by myself. So it should have been a rather small book and a book which would have taken 1 year or so to write. And then what happened is that I discovered once you've talked with De La Rosière, but also with Paul Volcker, by the way, and all the other, it was pretty easy to discuss with almost every other second rank, third rank actor. And moreover, at that point, you start thinking, oh, you should do your homework entirely, cleanly, and go into the archives. Finish off what you have started to do with the IMF archive, look for the Fed, look for the Bank of England. And therefore, it ended as a more academic book than I expected, and also one that took more years to finish than expected.
Well, I'm very glad that you did it, selfishly, because I teach a class on sovereign debt, as does Mark, and we're always looking for good material on that period of time, because there are a lot of people still around who have memories, but memories are fading, as I think you say in your introduction, and there's not enough been written about it. And as memories fade, folk tales emerge. Yeah. And I'm always worried.
These VIPs I've been talking to, well, they are between 85 and 95. So in a sense, there was no time to lose.
Well, so true. But moving a little bit, I was wondering if you could give us a sense of what you think of as the broad takeaway, the big theme, the big story for you. And then we'll come back with what we see.
Yeah, I think, well, the first point is probably the prehistory of the debt crisis. That means the what I call the shortest debt cycle in history, which started about 1972-73 and collapsed entirely in 1982. So you have the shortest 10 years debt cycle. And although I'm not revisiting the whole history about so-called petrodollar recycling, still, when you read the archives, read the law books, read how the so-called syndication loans were structured, you are so surprised by how weak this market was at that time, how limited information was, how limited screening of issuing countries you had. And in this sense, the fact that it entirely collapsed is not fully, can be understood quite well. It's quite curious. And I have an incredible quotation, in fact, by Paul Volcker, remembering his days at the New York Fed in around 76, 78, saying essentially that he realized that the largest American banks with large international activity were just not supervised. Only the domestic activities were. There's nobody looking at how much risk they took on international loans and so on. So that's the first point. Then I think that there is this restructuring regime which was built around the IMF and by the IMF. And I have elements on the kind of how the IMF worked on the trial and error basis from 1976, 77 to 82, and in a kind of ex post, rather consistent way, developed the first know-how base. But beyond that, you have something which in long historical perspective has not been often underlined, is this is the only restructuring regime that was by and large multilateral, extraterritorial, no link to the national judicial and legal system, including the US. That means the banks, the countries, the loans were in a sense uploaded on a completely ad hoc platform, which was built and operated by the IMF. And you never got anything like this. Before that and after that, as we know, sovereign debts have been restructured much more closely to the financial markets, the financial places where they've been issued. Then I think that I have elements. There isn't. I have elements on what went wrong. Because if this platform is this approach is most remarkable analytically and historically, it might be said it failed in a sense, insofar as you got three attempts at bringing the crisis to an end, 82, 85 with the so-called Baker Plan, which failed. And at last you had the Brady Plan 1989, which extended well into the early 1990s. So it took a lot of time. And there is an economic discussion of what happened there. Why was it not possible that the first restructuring and adjustment program did not deliver by 85? And what I assume is, and what you saw at that time, you had a big discussion on the so-called debt overhang, which was essentially a macroeconomic concept of excess debt vis-a-vis the capacity of the whole economy to serve. And what I argue is that, in fact, there was a more kind of intricate situation where the countries were intrinsically weak, had the low saving rates, had low investment rate, had low open ratio of openness. And in these conditions, they remain extremely fragile, extremely dependent about capital inflows in order to recover. And out of this situation, it became the mere expectation that at a point they may fall back into default or quasi-default and restructuring became a major problem for them. So there was a kind of endogeneity. As long as you might expect a new restructuring, capital would not flow in and this economy would stall, would not recover. And the last point is about the Brady Plan, which I interpret as mostly a mark-to-market operation, more than a write-off, a pure write-off thing. And beyond that, I think it's most important to see how the success of the Brady Plan not only accelerated the development of bond-based capital market, but was also very much supported by it. You had a very close interaction between the emergence of those markets and how capital immediately flew back into this country from 91, 92 on and allowed the economy to recover. So briefly speaking, my reading of the end of the crisis is much more liquidity-driven than macroeconomically driven. It was not so much an overhang story than one of finding ways to reassure investors that no restructuring would happen in the coming years, and therefore you can invest in the country. And once the money flow in, the economies do better.
So Jerome, there's so much there. And one of the takeaways that I have is just a reminder of how lacking in nuance some of the contemporary accounts are of this period. And I think my question is really just going to invite you to say a bit more, but I want to kind of set it up by saying that when I first started reading the sovereign debt literature, and I am more of an outsider to this field than you and me too are, I have to say, but there was a kind of a nice clean story about how in the era of syndicated bank lending, you know, coordination was easy. The big banks and U.S. Treasury could sort of arm twist the smaller banks. Everyone got in line, and you know, the transition to bond lending messed all of that up and introduced new coordination problems. And the sense I get from your book, of course, is much more complicated than that. And I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about what we know about the mechanisms for restructuring the syndicated bank loans and the ways in which the sort of arm twisting happened, and what happened to the smaller banks that were not willing to play ball. The story you tell in the book is so much more nuanced and interesting. I'm hoping that you can say a little more about it for our listeners.
Yeah, well, as we know, the generic bankruptcy procedure is about creditors controlling the assets, restructuring the firm, possibly liquidating it. So we see it primarily as a creditor-debtor story. But in practice, bankruptcy are primarily a mechanism for coordinating creditors between them. It's a collective action issue, which has been, I think, the most important dime over time, how you do that. And obviously you saw that emerging already in the late 1970s. The IMF was wondering, how far should we go into arm twisting? What can we do to resolve the obviously serious problem we have, may have in the future? And what happened is, indeed, it did not prove at all easy. And so a first step was from 1982 on, each time you had a restructuring, and especially when you had the most problematic dimension of it, which was so-called new money loans. That means the banks were not only expected to restructure existing loans, but to add new money to help the country. And at that point, they were expected to contribute on a pro-rata basis. Obviously, that was very difficult. So the smaller ones, smaller banks, regional banks, I don't know, Nebraska Farmers Banks or kind of Landesbanks in Germany, was expected to contribute. If it didn't work, then the bigger one in New York or in Frankfurt or in London would insist. And if it does not work, then you may have the big boys, like the head of Deutsche Bank or the boys or the head of Citicorp. And the last resort option, which was relied upon quite often, apparently, was for central banks and Minister of Finance to call on those banks 8:30 in the morning, I guess, and saying them, well, we insist, we expect you to contribute. And at that point, well, Minister of Finance, central bankers were doing things they would have never dreamed or never think of doing. And there was a lot of resistance. The Swiss, the German, the Dutch were completely upset by this, what was they expected to do with their own banks. And so what comes out here is that over the whole decades, you had an incredible degree, not only of coercion between private banks, but also between the public regulators and banks. And as a consequence, a considerable resistance. The policy establishment in those countries, but also in England, in Britain, were very much, although silently, resistant to what we can call the La Rosière-Volcker approach. And I guess that this has been one of the reasons why the whole regime of restructuring has been forgotten so rapidly. Things have been done which nobody expected the banks, central banks, to do.
So, Jerome, In terms of one of the big picture stories out of your book that I drew was, and please correct me, was that you standard comic story that is told in the sovereign debt literature about how everything is about reputation and, you know, the classic question of why do sovereigns repay, since it's so hard to enforce against them. And the story one always hears is, well, they repay because they need to borrow again. And my sense from the book is that you're a little bit skeptical that that need to borrow again explains everything.
I don't think it's enough, because the problem with the reputation argument, in a sense, is it's very generic. And it also kind of, in a crisis context, pulled all the weight of adjustment on the country. Adjust, reduce your deficit, reform your economy, which is for sure needed in most cases. But it's kind of imbalanced. And what I think is needed is to better take into account the pure negotiation here. And what I take as a kind of starting description is that, in fact, countries do have a reputation to go back to the market. That repudiation, as we know, has been extremely rare. And the point is, how, starting from the interest of the countries and obviously those of the lenders, how to find ways that kind of establish a bridge or a kind of path that would allow for a relatively predictable, relatively efficient ways to negotiate settlement. So it's not exactly procedure. but it's ways of meeting, given that both have an interest. But at the same time, banks often have an interest to extract as much as possible from the country, given their interest in finding a solution. So it's not a point of saying that reputation does not work, but it's more a way of kind of envisaging the ways, the paths, the steps that will allow the party to meet. And at that point, you have the difference between today's procedure, which were much more based in the US or in the, to lesser extent in London, New York or London, and by your position, the multilateral basis. How you get there, how you can have these so strikingly opposed interests gradually finding ways to commit themselves, to exchange information, to agree on red lines, and so on. So it's much a way of looking at the procedure.
Can we fast forward a little bit? I wanted to ask you about the Allied Bank case, which gets a reasonably lengthy treatment in your book. And I've been thinking about the Allied Bank case a bit of late because of the litigation that's going on involving Sri Lanka's debt and the position the U.S. government has taken there, which in some respects I view as kind of a U-turn, at least somewhat inconsistent with the position that it had taken back in connection with the Allied Bank litigation. So I'm wondering how you see Allied Bank and what its significance is, and if you've been following the Hamilton Bank litigation in Sri Lanka, whether you see any tension there between the U.S. government's earlier position, which was in effect, yes, we support voluntary restructurings, but we do so against an insistence that contracts are legally enforceable, and maybe a somewhat weaker version of that that perspective now.
Yeah, I've not been following the Sri Lanka case, so I'm afraid I can't make the comparison. But indeed, I mostly, when looking in some details at the Allied case, of course, I had all the discussions since the 1990s on litigation and so-called vulture fund and all that. I think what is interesting is, first of all, that the Allied case is probably the first occasion in history, and certainly the only one during the 80s, when the new restricted theory or doctrine of sovereign immunity was applied. Because, as you know, the main decision, the main statutes had been adopted in the late 1970s, 76, 77, if I'm correct, in Britain and the US. And quite curiously, these two statutes are not much mentioned. They could have drawn the whole debt restructuring story back to in the local courts, but that never happened. And in fact, all the parties at least agreed on that point. Never, ever go down to the courts. The IMF, the banks, the country, that was a nightmare for them. So you have a bizarre way of having this new restrictive doctrine of sovereign immunities, but nobody daring to move into that direction. And in fact, you would have to wait for the World Vulture Fund to actually mobilize or instrumentalize this new legal possibility. So against this background, the Allied case is indeed an occasion when an American court, I go over the details, actually sued Costa Rica, because three banks, which have taken a collective loan vis-a-vis American banks, had stopped paying, not because they could not individually pay, but because they did not have access to hard currency. The bank, the Costa Rica's National Central Bank, just refused to give them the dollar against their local peso. And the reason was they were negotiating with the IMF and with the London Club. And so the whole question at that point became, over three successive judicial decisions, how far does an ongoing negotiation and then a full agreement backed up by the IMF though primarily was the London Club, informal London Club with no specific legal existence, how far do this type of agreement justify capital controls? The decision by the central bank not to exchange the peso against the dollars. And at the end, the decision was, well, that's the problem. The decision was where the IMF program was the London Club Agreement beyond, was not strong enough, did not warrant a suspension of the rights of the creditors. So in a sense, it's anticipated well on the context of the 1990s and the year 2000s, where indeed the supremacy of the strength of the initial contracts is very strong. So they clearly move in that direction, but at the same time, litigating did not give separate benefit to the litigating bank. There was just one. So they won the case, but they were invited apparently by the IMF and the US government to settle privately on terms not very different on those of the London Club Agreement. So there was a kind of decision in principle that indeed US court keep jurisdiction over the said sovereign debt loans contracts, yet litigating should not be rewarded. So the courts say we are the ultimate protector of these contracts, but don't use us as a way to circumvent a collectively agreed settlement or debt restructuring, provided it is fair and acceptable to all parties. Okay?
So Jerome, just to dig a little deeper into Allied Bank, since from a legal perspective, these events are so important. First, to reiterate, I mean, the Sri Lanka case, I think you'll find fascinating, including the developments over the last couple of days. There at the district court level, the U.S. government has stepped in to ask the court and support Sri Lanka's request for a stay of litigation against it, on the grounds that Sri Lanka is making good progress in its restructuring talks as blessed by institutions like the IMF. So in some sense, the courts are taking, to me, a very different perspective on what they should be doing than did the final decision in the Allied Bank case. Now,
yes, the final.
Because the initial decisions in the Allied Bank case were very pro, let's support the restructuring, sure. Let's enable this to happen, very much what you would expect a court of equity to do in a context where you don't have bankruptcy. And this is something that U.S. courts had done in prior decades, say with the railroad restructurings, and that sort of developed modern law. But one of the things that I don't remember you're talking about is, this takes me back, and maybe Mark can correct me, to a couple of points that, one point that you made, another point that you don't make, and I'm curious about it. One point that you made was about the restrictive theories of sovereign immunity. My memory of those documents in Allied Bank is that all of those syndicated loans had explicit contractual waivers of sovereign immunity. So, I mean, the background law in some sense was not really relevant because you could contract for a waiver of sovereign immunity. And that, yes. And I think, as Mark's work has shown, it happened since the early 1900s. But the other thing I'm curious about is the flip in the U.S. courts that happens between the Court of Appeals and the en banc decision, which is, you know, you have a Court of Appeals decision. And Mark, I don't know if you remember, was it an en banc? Because I don't think you can ask the Court of Appeals to just decide again because you didn't like the first decision. But the U.S. government the administration changes. And also there's all the drama about the Contras and the Reagan administration. And so the politics in Washington radically change between the early decisions and the later decisions. And so I'm sort of, maybe you decided that wasn't an important part of the story, but I'm curious about it and about the choice as to how to talk about. Mark, did I get that totally upside down before I bothered Jerome about it? I don't know if you remember the details.
I wish I did. I don't remember. I mean, there is a panel rehearing process, so it's not like you have to go en banc to get a panel decision changed. The panel itself can do it on rehearing, but I don't remember which one Allied Bank involved.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly. And not being either your lawyer nor an American, I may have not have the whole information. Is that indeed, if I'm correct, the third decision was made on a rehearing at the same court of appeal as the second one, if I'm correct, and in between. You had, if I'm correct, a very strong public campaign in the media, in the financial press, including in the Financial Times in London, saying, that's horrible what you are doing. You are exposing creditor banks to all the vicissitude of dealing with the sovereign, you remove protection, that's awful. And from there on, if I'm correct, came a second decision that actually reinstated this principle that the fees courts remain the last resort guarantor of those contracts. This is how I read it. Whether the Contra and the Reagan administration played here, I did not find a trace. I mostly saw a strong campaign, mostly within the financial banking profession, saying you should not do that. We want to keep the debt contracts ultimately under U.S. jurisdiction. Don't move in the direction of a kind of supranational or multilateral forum where this protection would be kind of diluted. This is how I understood it.
So I do think I will be interested to hear your thoughts later offline when we talk about you get a chance to see the U.S. government's position in this Hamilton Bank litigation, which is it quite interesting. I guess technically one can try to harmonize it with the position the government has taken historically, but it also has the feeling of a kind of retcon job where the government's position has changed, but it's trying to characterize it in a manner that makes it seem consistent. I want to switch gears if we can, as we move towards the end of the podcast. This is a sort of a tangential question, but it caught my eye as I was reading, and so I wanted to ask you about it. And the question's about Joseph Gold. So you spend some time on Gold, who was the early director of the IMF legal department, and you point out that he is kind of an overlooked figure in kind of the modern understanding of the IMF and in many of the historical treatments of the IMF. And I guess I'm wondering what importance you attribute to Joseph Gold and why you think he's been relatively overlooked.
Well, the reason why he has been relatively overlooked, I think, is that those who have been working on IMF, by and large, have been economists. And as you know, economists don't care a lot with lawyers.
I do know that.
Even in those times. I mean, lawyers are not very much present in the public debate on the debt crisis of the 80s. The point about Joseph Gold is, indeed, he was present at the IMF, I think, almost from creation to the early 1980s. And the key contribution, at least from the perspective of this book, he is the inventor of the standby agreement, which is lending against policy conditionality. And if you read at the if you read the economic literature in particular, but also the political economic one, I mean, conditionality or conditional loans are often perceived as, in a very blunt terms, there are some kind of diktat. There are just a record of everything the IMF is imposing on the countries, which is not always completely wrong, but lacks the actual construction of the standby. And who invented it? That was Joseph Gold. And here, he has a long series of articles, maybe 10, 12 of them, from the 1950s to the late 1970s, on how should we understand standby agreements. And I think what a very striking point on which he insisted a lot and apparently repeated to outgoing IMF mission to Argentina or any other places, they say, never ever use a contractual vocabulary. A standby is not a contract. Looking at the relationship between fund and country with this private law vocabulary leads you nowhere. And he said what it is, it's not completely clear. It's very sui generis. And in particular, insisted this is mostly some kind of two-way exchanges of commitments, which de facto, where the country de facto announces, formally announces its policy priorities for the coming 1 or 2, 3 years, and where in parallel, the IMF commit itself to actually make some money available. And at that point, he insists on a nice point, which is in an ongoing relation between a crisis country and the IMF, you never, ever see a single document with a signature of the two countries or representatives or officials from both. That means the Minister of Finance and the head of the IMF. Never. So these are more kind of two ways parallel, non-contractual commitment, which are then backed up by the system of tranches and repetitive multi-meetings, exchanges of information, accepted, implicitly acceptance that the country will be cheating, that the IMF itself can hide its opinions, and so on. So it's completely structured around this notion of negotiation, but also the recognition by the country remains a sovereign, cannot be bound by something like a contract. You should expect it to cheat. You should expect that the government to be exposed to domestic pressure. And the whole construction of the standby very much revolves around that. How can you actually exchange policy commitment that would prove broadly credible with an animal like this? And in this sense, the standby is very much a reflection of our primary question, what it is and how can you lend to a sovereign? And the fact that the standbys were the vehicle of restructuring during the 1980s, of course, makes the point even more significant, I would say.
So, Jerome, we're getting to the end. Oh, and I need to, Mark, thankfully, told me. So Allied Bank was a panel rehearing, not the full Second Circuit, which is a very crucial, to me, very crucial part of the story, because at least in my experience, and maybe Mark has a different one, but panels of Court of Appeals, courts almost never just say, oh, we goofed, we're going to hear this again. Usually you have to go to the en banc. And in fact, I think in my many years of clerking, I never saw it happen. No court was ever willing to reverse it. And that is why the story of the change in the U.S. government's position, at least in terms of them stepping in at one stage to say, you guys need to decide differently, is so crucial. And we see this very unusual legal move happen with the panel rehearing. Now, that might be too much legal detail for you, Jerome. There's no reason you should be obsessed with it.
I think it fits with my story, even though the detail I didn't know. It truly came, the demand for rehearing the case was truly policy or politically driven. There was a campaign. There was an
upstart. Yeah. No, it fits very nicely then, with your story.
And then, as you said, indeed, the court was invited to rehear the case. And it's interesting indeed, highly interesting indeed, that this is so rare. And
No, it indeed fits with your story very well. Like something radically happened that they had to change their position, because court of appeals judges, who are very high up in the status hierarchy in the U.S., do not acknowledge error.
Well, yeah, we can understand that.
But Jerome, as my last question, and I wish I had left more time to talk about this, but we didn't, and we have to wrap. You have a fascinating discussion in the book of buybacks, and when one looks at the bond buybacks, or you know, syndicated loan buybacks at a discount, and so many of these Latin American debts in particular were trading at incredibly deep discounts, maybe 10 cents on the dollar sometimes, and one would think that a buyback strategy, particularly if you know, the country doesn't tell everybody that it's going to do a buyback, like a secret buyback strategy, would be very effective. And my impression from casual reading of papers like Bulow and Rogoff, where I think they have that paper, The Buyback Boondoggle, where they are quite critical of certain kinds of buybacks, was that buybacks didn't happen that much. But reading your book, and there's some references to Lee Buchheit and Ross Buckley, and it seems like there actually were quite a number of secret buybacks, or even some cases where the countries sort of stopped paying the debt and the price of the debt went down, and then they did a buyback, which, you know, very clever. But I was wondering if you could tell us about the buyback part of the story.
And I don't have in mind now the proportion of it, but indeed it was quite large. Not as large as the Brady, but quite substantial for a number of countries like Chile, for instance, if I'm correct. And I think indeed that the buybacks might have become the default option if the Brady have not been launched. That means if the Bush administration had decided, we keep the line of the Reagan administration, no write-off, no government intervention, that could have worked. The question is, first, that you would have a lot of heterogeneity, probably. And the question then is that beyond the issue of debt, you have the one of capital reflow. How can you be sure that you not only solve your old debt problem, but yet you present yourself on the market as a promising option country, that indeed in the future it's worth putting more money? So what I'm not completely clear about is, if you take this market-based approach, which also included, for instance, exchange of debt against shares in privatized state-owned enterprise and so on, this could have actually delivered. But the question is how much time would you have to wait before capital reflow in those countries and growth is primed? This I am not sure. So eventually, although there's a judgmental dimension here, I think the Brady was its kind of very much policy-driven approach might have been a more efficient way of bringing back those countries into the markets, allow capital to flow in and lift growth.
Well, Jerome, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. The book, The Debt Crisis of the 1980s, as I said at the beginning, has so much fascinating and certainly to me, and I think to others, new detail and rich detail from the IMF archives and elsewhere. It was really a treat to read. I'm looking forward to using it in my sovereign debt class. And I really appreciate you coming on to spend some time talking with us about it. Thanks, Jerome.